Welcome to Debate at GO8, the podcast series canvassing issues affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. The Group of Eight comprises Australia's leading research-intensive universities, the universities of Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, Western Australia, Adelaide, the Australian National University, Monash University, and UNSW Sydney. As a leader, the GO8 strives to influence the development and delivery of long-term, sustainable national higher education and research policy. It also develops elite international alliances and research partnerships. In this, our third instalment in an ongoing podcast series, we'll again look at the importance of international students to the university sector and the Australian economy, and the ongoing plans to welcome them back on campus. Well, Vicky Thompson, CEO of the Group of Eight Universities, in our first instalment regarding international students, we spoke about the importance of international students to the economy more generally. In this instalment, I'd really like to zero in on the strategies for the future. We touched on that previously, but obviously a lot of work has been done. How difficult is it to hang on to international students who have stood by GO8 universities during the pandemic?
Well, surprisingly, Ron, it's been really positive. Those students who are already enrolled with us have stuck with us. And these are students who actually haven't been able to be here. You know, I think we've got about 30,000 students currently offshore at the moment who are still enrolled with us and are still studying online. So that is really testament to the fact, to them, but also to the fact that, you know, we've got a pretty good product and a great education offering. Where the challenge will be is in recruiting new students and getting new students who may start their studies online, and they understand that. Many other countries' borders are closed as well, so it's not just Australia. But they do want to know that at some point over their 3, 4, 5 year degree, they will be coming to Australia to actually complete their degree. And that's the kind of missing link at the moment in terms of bringing them back.
Now, you touched on this in our previous discussion about international students. How do you develop the strategy to bring them back? I mean, obviously, you're in discussions with the Commonwealth over this in a big way, I'd imagine.
We are. And each of our universities are working very closely with their state governments. And the state governments will then, the process is they'll have to take it up through National Cabinet and through that process. But what we have been doing as a group of universities, and remembering that we've got, you know, a significant proportion, 1 in 3 international students in Australia study at a group of eight universities. So we've got a lot of skin in this game. And what we've been doing is going out and talking to other industry sectors and other industry partners. So the property council, the defence sector, the real estate institute, the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the business council, everybody who's got some skin in the game as it relates to international students, and working with them and saying, okay, we need to work together on a safe and secure corridor strategy to get our existing students back, but also to provide some level of assurance to new students that Australia is still a good option. So what we did was we actually literally got together on the Zoom room, as we do now in post-COVID times, with a whole bunch of stakeholders, and we developed a series of 5 key principles that we think should underpin our education strategy, if you like. And then from that, then looking at how we actually bring those students back in. So I'll just briefly, those 5 sort of principles were... And these are important to understand why we come up with these 5 principles, because it really goes to why do we even have an international education market? Why is it important? Why are we putting so much energy into ensuring that it's, you know, it continues? And we've talked about that in our previous episode. International engagement is absolutely critical to the development of our sovereign capability and our economic competitiveness, and international education underpins that. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that. We think that international education and research needs to be leveraged to drive Australia's economy post-COVID. We hear the government talking about new industries, ag tech, advanced manufacturing. All of that will be underpinned by...
Space industry,
yep. Defence, underpinned by international education, research, and our own, of course. we also should be looking at it in the geopolitical context. You know, it's pretty tricky times at the moment. And so international education is a fantastic lever in terms of those people-to-people relationships. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that we've got a good international education sector which can underpin the sometimes very difficult geopolitical interests.
So you're talking particularly through the Indo-Pacific region.
Yep. You know, I mean, everyone's aware of sort of where that's at. And look, it's out of our hands, but let's leverage the thing that is working really well, and mm-hmm. that is international education. We're seen as, Australia is seen as really very positively in this light. And then the fifth one is around actually demonstrating to the Australian community the value of international education to Australia. So, and I'm not talking about just the economic value, but the value of having international students and international researchers in Australia. Once we've sort of agreed on those principles, which we did, we thought, okay, these are pretty good, mm-hmm. and this should underpin what our international education strategy should look like. Now, how do we actually get that happening, and how do we get the borders opened and in a safe and secure way so that the broader community is satisfied that we're not compromising on anybody's safety, because that's certainly not something that we would want to be a part of. That is actually another part of the puzzle, which is a little bit more complex, in that we have to have very clear pathways around quarantining. Mm-hmm. There's been some suggestion, well, why can't we just have quarantining at our universities, for example? All of our universities have huge residential colleges. The medical experts say to us that's not appropriate. You know, we've seen the problems with hotel quarantining, mm-hmm. And we would not want to break out from a university residential college. So that's probably not an option for us, even though we thought that it could be. But we investigated all of those things. We have to ensure that our students are vaccinated so that they're safe and that our own students and population are safe. It has to be over and above the caps that the government has put on Australian citizens returning to Australia. That's fine. We can work around that as well. And so what I think you'll start to see, and in fact, I think in the federal budget and post the federal budget, the Prime Minister has indicated potentially some small pilots. I think we'll see small pilots. So I know South Australia is ready to go. Mm-hmm. The Chief Medical Officer has signed off on their strategy. It has to go through National Cabinet. Federal government controls the borders.
I was going to say, I mean, we mentioned in the previous instalment the huge impact for state economies from international students, and obviously they are dead keen to fire up this sector again because it's, you know, worth so much money mm-hmm. to them. But it's the Commonwealth that currently has a very conservative approach to opening up the borders. Mm-hmm. And with an election looming within a year or so, are you concerned that that level of conservatism about border openings, et cetera, will get in the way of opening up this industry more particularly, or this sector more particularly?
I am. And it's not just about the international education market. You know, we've heard the CEO of Qantas talking about mm-hmm. borders. We've heard
Virgin.
We've heard the Minerals Council. You know, name a peak body. They've all said fruit pickers. You know, we need to get people in. Migration's important for Australia, and the federal government controls the borders, and that is the reality. I think that, you know, and I've said this previously, there's always a political overlay to everything. We saw it in Western Australia. The borders were very tightly closed in an intrastate kind of context in Australia, if you like. And I think that there is a proportion of the community that, we might label as the worried well, who are very happy that our borders are closed because they feel safe. Mm. And that's understandable. So what the challenge is, we need to be able to demonstrate that we can bring in our international students, in my case, that's what I'm talking about here, in a safe way for both the students that we want to bring in, but also for the broader Australian community. We do not want to compromise on that safety, but we do believe that we can do it in small numbers to start off with. So I wouldn't want anyone to be thinking, you know, I've talked about 30,000 students offshore. We're not proposing, let's bring 30,000 students in 2 weeks. The sort of pilot that we've looked at in Victoria, in South Australia, has been literally 200 or 300 students over a 4 or 5 month period. So you're talking about maybe 10 students, and then maybe another 10, and then maybe another 10.
In very specific courses.
And also specific courses and specific countries. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the federal government has said to us is that, You know, we need to diversify where those students are coming in from. Now, that will be challenging because the majority of our students at the Group of Eight are our Chinese students, those 30,000 I talked about. But we also have students in Indonesia, in Hong Kong, in Japan, in South Korea, Singapore. So, you know, there's a raft of countries that we can draw upon to bring those students in. But look, in all reality, that will address an issue for us in the short term. The longer term issue is, what happens in 2022, 2023, when we're wanting to bring in new students?
Mm-hmm.
And that pipeline of students is where we are really concerned.
Now, you mentioned before some encouraging figures in terms of the 1% decline.
For our universities, for the Group of Eight universities, our enrolments are down by about 1% compared to March last year.
But some universities... There have been some reports that which state that international student numbers have plunged by about a third since COVID struck at other universities. So are we seeing what is the tip of the iceberg on this issue?
I think, look, a really good example is the Australian National University. So and the Vice-Chancellor, Professor Brian Schmidt, has spoken on this, and he'd be a great person actually to get on to talk about this. So that university made a strategic decision well before COVID to cap their international student numbers. So that was a decision they made as a university for whatever reason, fine. But what's happened now is they have had a significant impact because having made that decision, then we had COVID. In a way, they're the canary in the coal mine. We are, or at least our universities, are sort of just starting to be where they are through a decision that they actually made, if you get my point.
Yep.
So... we are really concerned and, you know, as I said, we have huge exposure because we have such a significant number of students at our universities about what this means for our pipeline of students coming in. And that is why, and I know I keep repeating myself, but that is why the messaging of a transition strategy to opening our borders is so important. Because right now there are students overseas who, with their parents, are making decisions about where they'll study. There are researchers. Where will we go and do our research and who with? Oh, we can't get to Australia and we don't know when we can. So they'll go to the UK, they'll go to Canada. And I can tell you, because I talk to my counterparts, they're ramping up their recruitment drives.
So they're making a real pitch for these people.
They're rubbing their hands with glee and they're seeing an absolute increase in enrolments on the back of our decrease in enrolments here in Australia.
So ultimately, you've got to deal with that issue pretty quickly. We've got to get some resolution from the Commonwealth on that issue, as you say. Otherwise, people in those countries will make choices about other places to send their kids.
We do. I don't think that there's any great urgency from the federal government's perspective, and I say that in the context of, you know, any great announcements in the next 2 or 3 months. From the federal government, they've been very clear that you know Australian citizens must come home first, and only when it is safe will we open the borders more generally. And we've got to work around that, which is you know somewhat challenging, but that's the environment within which we're operating.
Can you offer further incentives? You know, I know decisions have to be made about vaccinations, border openings, et cetera, but the University of Queensland, another GO8 university, has bucked the recent trend in declining international student numbers. UQ offered students studying offshore a 12.5% rebate on fees. Is that the way of the future?
Well, I think, you know, and far be it for me to comment because we don't collude on those sorts of issues as a Group of Eight universities. But at the end of the day, our universities are also big businesses. You know, some of our universities are $3 billion businesses, and that's a statistic that often surprises people. And they have to make some tough decisions. And a huge part of their revenue has just kind of gone or is going. And so how do they actually ensure that they can keep the students they've got and ensure that they can get new ones? Like any industry, they're going to have to look at perhaps their fee structure and what other incentives they can offer.
But isn't the problem there, though, that eventually you cheapen the whole notion of university, that you know you devalue it over time in this rush to get people back
online? I don't think we'd be giving education away for free. You know, it is as I said, it is a market-driven commodity, if you like. And some of my university counterparts would not like that terminology, but that is what it is. And it's a competitive environment. It always has been a competitive environment. And we have been competing not just amongst ourselves, but with the UK and the US, Canada, et cetera, as I've mentioned. So no, I don't think it devalues the currency, as you've put it. I think the challenge is for our students who are studying offshore, online is a great option. And, you know, we have been talking and our universities are literally in contact with our students on a very regular basis. The question is, how long is that sustainable? A student is going to enrol and they may take advantage of a reduced fee structure, but eventually they are going to want to come to Australia and have an international education experience on our campuses, because that's what it's all about. And so the sustainability of offering discounts to study online for a long period of time, I think, is somewhat questionable.
So you're looking at this whole strategy long term, and you've talked about these discussions that you've been having with the Property Council, the Real Estate Institute, others, et cetera. Just explain to me, the Real Estate Institute, how does that figure in terms of international students? I mean, I think our audience would like to know, you know, how that plays into the local real estate market in some way.
Well, students have to lay their head somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, they have to sleep somewhere. And they're a huge part of the real estate infrastructure in our cities. If you think about the tens of thousands of international students we've got, when we're talking about PhDs, they often come, because a PhD would generally be slightly older, they'll often come with a partner and sometimes with children. So we're not just talking about, you know, 18-year-olds turning up and staying.
And when their families come to visit them, they need a place to stay as well.
I had a really interesting discussion actually with the Property Council, who said there's kind of a two-speed economy happening in the property industry at the moment, where, you know, renovations, and I'm sure, you know, we've all been, you know, we've been renovating and doing all those sorts of things, that's going through the roof. But apartment vacancy rates are also through the roof, because a lot of those apartments are taken up by our university students. And so that's why they've got some skin in the game, because
right.
we've got a lot of empty real estate across the nation, which would ordinarily be filled by our international students. Now, we do have student housing, and they're, you know, big businesses which run residential student housing separate to our universities. They too are suffering. I mean, a lot of students, and this is an interesting point, a lot of students when COVID hit, particularly for Australia, as opposed to our competitors, because of where we were in the cycle of our year, we're at the beginning of our year. A lot of our students had gone home for Chinese New Year.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't able to come back. And they literally had left their apartments. And in fact, I know in one case, the vice chancellor of one of my universities went round to pick up the cat, because they no one was there to look after the cat. They thought they were just gone for a few days.
Right.
So they literally left their apartments and they haven't been able to come back.
Yeah.
So these are the sorts of issues that people probably don't think about.
These are the sorts of issues that really emphasise the powerful impact that these international students have in the daily lives of everyone living in Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne, you name it.
Absolutely.
They have a profound impact. And it's kind of a hidden impact, isn't it, really? Or it has been for a long time.
I think we've just taken it for granted. And look, I think that's actually been a really positive thing, because we just are such an integrated, multicultural society that, you know, seeing, you know, many nations represented is quite normal for Australians. That's how we operate. That's who we are, as, you know, that's the central part of who we are. But now what we see, of course, is, you know, cafes are empty and real estate is empty and, you know, that economic impact is not there. You know, I think I've mentioned previously, you know, every three international students at a group of eight generates $1 million in economic activity into our pubs, our clubs, our rent, our food, you know, our 7-Elevens and what have you. That's not there.
Mm.
So that has an impact on those particularly small businesses. And we have spoken to the Small Business Association about that. You know, if they're not in there spending money, they're not there. So that has a knock-on effect in terms of employment levels, all of those sorts of things. So there is this multiplier effect that is not kind of recognised or understood until we start to talk about it and you start to see it.
And if anything, there's been criticism of the GO8 and universities more generally about having too heavy reliance on international students, and the pandemic has exposed their reliance on student numbers, et cetera. But the information that you've given us today shows that they're absolutely vital to the the expanding Australian economy if we are to expand again.
I mean, I find this over-reliance argument really frustrating because there isn't a sector of the economy who isn't reliant on some kind of international transaction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always talk about our wine industry, our beef industry, our agricultural industry. We are part of that economic fabric of the nation, and we have done nothing more or less than what every other sector of the economy has done. But actually, our economic impact has been ignored. People know and understand that, you know, we export sheep and cattle, and they go, oh, yeah, that's great. They don't think about our international education market as an export sector. Mm. And that's what it is. And that does impact on our local economies.
So as we look towards the end of this year and the beginning of next, the way things are panning out doesn't look particularly good for the reintroduction of big student numbers into Australia next year. So what are the challenges then that you see for the GO8 universities and universities more generally, given that this is such a powerful driver for, you know, their business plan?
So it's a huge challenge. And in fact, we're more worried about 22, 23 than potentially 2020 COVID. It was just like, what the hell's going on? Mm. 2021, we're just kind of trying to sort of muddle our way through. But we are not expecting growth in international enrolments for semester two onwards into 22-23 in the current context. So what that means is that our universities are busily looking at their business models. So, you know, we've already seen significant job cuts in our universities across the Group of Eight, in all universities, but obviously across the Group of Eight. We've seen reduction in capital expenditure. And why does that matter? Now, people might be going, okay, well, university's got all these great buildings. And but if we're not actually either maintaining our facilities or upgrading or building new facilities, that means we're not employing, you know, workers who work on construction workers. We're not doing that. So that's another part of the economy that people don't understand, which we've been hit by not having international students. So, you know, it's a long bow to draw that people may not understand, that no international students means no capital expenditure here, means there's no jobs in the construction industry for that part of the economy.
So your son or daughter who may work in that area
might be an apprentice mechanic
or an apprentice
engineer rather, or a bricklayer, a tradesperson.
Suddenly it has a profound impact.
It has an impact. And so they're the sorts of things we're now looking at: a hold on capital expenditure, our employment numbers and what do we do around that. Because it's very difficult to replace such a significant source of revenue. It is just impossible to do.
What about the very viability of some universities then?
So for the Group of Eight universities, I wouldn't question our longevity. You know, we've been around, we're the oldest universities in the country. And at the end of the day, we are public. We are all public universities. You would hope that our federal government would not allow a university to actually shut its doors. However, we have had examples of this in the United States, where one university, in Canada, actually had to declare bankruptcy because of the impact of COVID and a lack of international students and the business model. I don't think we're there, and I think we're skating on thin ice. There's no doubt about that. But it would be a lot for a big Group of Eight university to close down. What it does mean, though, Ron, because we are so research intensive, we won't be able to do the scale and the breadth of the university, the depth and breadth of the research that we do.
Which is, as you said in the first instalment, touches on that notion of sovereign capability.
Exactly.
What sort of Australia we want to live in the decades ahead.
And so some tough decisions will need to be made in consultation with government, can I say, because a lot of our research is with government, with the Department of Defence and others, CSIRO. We will have to make some tough decisions about the scale of the research that we do and the type of research we do, because a lot of that research relies on global PhDs, you know, global research partners. If we don't have access to that, it means we can't do it. So I don't think we're closing the doors, but we're certainly having to make some tough decisions on the business model and our research capabilities.
Well, hopefully in future we can talk again about strategies for the future, about bringing back this all-important international student component back to our universities. Thanks very much today.
Thanks, Ron.
Well, there's certainly plenty more to be done to bring international student numbers back to pre-COVID levels. As you've just seen, they're incredibly important to the university sector and the broader Australian economy. If you'd like more information on the ideas discussed in this episode or other related topics, visit our website at go8.edu.au. We look forward to your company next time. Bye for now.